It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk with an expert about the presidential election in South Korea and how it could affect ongoing tensions with North Korea.
First, Americans are no strangers to outcry and controversy following police-involved shootings, especially of African-American men. Recently, a Texas family filed a lawsuit against a Dallas-area police officer. They are arguing that he used excessive and deadly force when he shot at a car which their son, 15-year-old Jordan Edwards, was sitting in. After being taken to the hospital, Edwards was pronounced dead after suffering a shot to the head.
In the wake of several high-profile police shootings, citizens and lawmakers have grappled with how police and communities can build trust. It's an issue here in Wisconsin, too. After Sylville Smith was fatally shot in Milwaukee last year, the city's Sherman Park neighborhood saw protests and riots break out.
State Senator Lena Taylor is from Milwaukee and represents the state's 4th District. She announced plans to improve relations between police and communities through a package of bills she's going to be rolling out this session. She joins us now. Senator Taylor, welcome to Central Time.
It's truly my pleasure to be with you.
Before we get into the specific initiatives, big picture, what are you hoping to accomplish for police-community relations in Wisconsin?
I want to make police officers' jobs easier. I want to make communities safer. I want communities to feel safe from not only the people creating havoc in communities, but also from the people who take an oath to protect and serve. I don't want officers to have bad images or reputations, and I don't want officers to have to be biased by the challenges that exist because communities have a lack of trust. And so what I want to do is help us build that trust and help communities learn to be partners in public safety.
A big part of that is in one of your initiatives related to community-oriented policing. What kind of changes are you looking for?
I really want to encourage a model that I saw in Racine called cop houses. And I know that Senator Wangard is also interested, and we've talked about how we can partner in order to move that kind of initiative forward. But in particular, they were able to reduce their violent crime by like 60-70%, also in collaboration, not only with the community, but also federally. And so this is the kind of work that I'd like to see. I want to make sure, though, that we keep the community in the policing, not just a model like what we did in Milwaukee, where the community component was not, for lack of a better way to say it, beefed up enough. And then in the community, we have to keep the unity in the community by making sure that we allow the people who are at the grassroots level to be able the ones who are giving input, not just someone saying, this is what the community's message should be.
Let's talk about that cop house idea. I'll admit, this was new to me. This is actually buying an old house, in a way, and making it a local community-centered police branch, is that right?
Exactly. Not just a police branch, but imagine a police office, a hub for city inspectors, a place for probation agents to meet with individuals, a place where neighborhood associations have their meetings, and a place where the community gardens. That's what a cop house is. It is really a collaborative effort, a hub, if you would go with me there, for collaborative work to rebuild and strengthen communities. It's a place where people are able to go and get training. Maybe it's also a fab lab that's at a cop house. I mean, it really could be whatever a community defines it to be for them.
And how would your legislation help encourage that?
What it would do is encourage individuals to create those kinds of hubs and to create those kind of collaborations that in turn would then show addressing community policing as the issue that they or public increasing public safety as the issue they want to work on. And so if someone does that, then this legislation would encourage funding also even for savings that they may create. Those are the concepts that are in the legislation, in the effort, and more importantly, my hope is to get bipartisan support on that kind of effort, because literally their crime was down to a 50-year low in Racine using these kind of models.
Turning to another initiative, you were heavily involved in the Wisconsin law that requires an outside investigation after a police-involved death. You now want to take that a step further. What do you want to see change?
Yes, I'd love to see 2.0. I'd love to see a better transparency so that we could build trust. In particular, the body cams and the videos from the vehicles to make those accessible to the families sooner. Versus later, and then a different time potentially for the community, but definitely for the families of those that have been victimized to be able to get some level of peace, right, and knowledge and understanding. I also like the changes that the Attorney General put in that require now that the officers can't see the video until they've done their report and they've been interviewed.
And how about who is actually doing the investigating of one of these police-involved deaths? Does that,
would
that change?
Very important that it not be individuals from the very law enforcement agency that is in question, that they would be doing the investigations. I know that there have been some ways that we've come around that. In particular, they created a suburban group, and they are doing it in the Milwaukee area. I believe that the legislation missed that, and so we need to make sure that we make that clear.
We're talking to State Senator Lena Taylor about a package of initiatives, bills in the legislature she's working for on police-community relations. Another big issue, and this has been controversial, especially in the Milwaukee area, residency requirements for police officers. Milwaukee and other communities had this. There's been a back and forth with the state legislature and the courts over this. Why is it important to you that local governments be able to, if they want to, require police officers to live in the city boundaries?
I think that it's important that police not occupy a particular community, but that they are a part, that they're a member of that community. In order to understand what the pulse of that community is, and to understand the people and the ways that they communicate. And so in particular, cultural competency, mental health, those are issues that often are a major part of a community. And so I not only think that people should get that training through legislation, but I also think that when someone is a resident of the community, they understand those pieces and how to interact. You don't have to explain to somebody what a community is about. I think it's much more challenging. I think you get more of an occupying mindset than you get a supportive mindset that way.
But some police officers say, and this has been up in the courts, that this limits their rights to choose where they want to live. And then people say it makes it harder maybe to hire police officers if they're restricted in where they can live.
I think that, you know, the argument that I can't find, you know, any good people is an argument that you just might need to, you know, have some other people help you find some people. You might need to, you know, try to communicate to some different medians, just some different venues. It really is not about saying where you can't live. It's saying if you want this job, it means that you need to do these things because it will help you to do the job more effectively and candidly keep a community safer and keep you safer.
Then you also talk about a shot spotter. This is something that's currently in use in Milwaukee, enabling police departments to track when and where gunshots are fired. What do you want to see expanded there?
I love the program. The program basically tells you where shots are. They're able to identify those shots, and most importantly, even if people don't call in. And so I think that that's really important. It gives us the kind of growth that we need in our communities around the issue of calls to say what's going on. And so I love it. It is technology at its best. And so we have it already. It is proven to be successful. And it basically tells if there are gunshots here and pinpoint where.
You also have, just going through the list, you've got a lot going on here, efforts to make sure that racial profiling isn't used by police departments.
You know, that is an area that we surely need to grow in, and what I really want to be able to do is to help us to see that. Help us to see that if we are in a community that is the most segregated in the nation, that it just kind of means that we should work on the issues around race and our own personal biases.
And then finally, you're looking for changes in the training in law enforcement. What kind of things would you like to see more focus on? Maybe what kind of things would you like to see less focus on?
Mental health, cultural competency, those are some of the major areas that I'd like to see us to grow on. I really want curbside manner to be something, how you speak, to the individuals that you police and the communities that you serve, I think is also a really important piece. And I don't think there's enough of that.
As we wrap up, there's a lot here. Do you think you can get support from police departments themselves and from the Republican majority in the Senate?
I truly will be working on it. I don't expect that all of the matters will go forward, but I hope that some of the items will. And more importantly, I hope that we'll at very least have the dialogue.
We'll leave it there for now. Senator Taylor, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate you seeing this important topic and bringing voice to it.
That was State Senator Lena Taylor from Milwaukee. She represents Wisconsin's 4th District. She joined us to talk about a package of bills she's going to be introducing aimed at improving police-community relations in Wisconsin. Right now, we're looking at the presidential election results from South Korea, which were just released today. Moon Jae-in was the candidate of the Liberal Democratic Party in South Korea. He's the nation's new president. Experts say Moon's victory will likely mean an overhaul in that nation's policy on North Korea. This comes as the Trump administration has been focusing on the region in recent weeks.
Scott Snyder joins us now. He's a senior fellow for Korea Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of South Korea at the Crossroads, Autonomy and Alliance in an Era of Rival Powers. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, was it a surprise to hear that Moon Jae-in won South Korea's presidential election?
It was not really a surprise. He had been the front runner throughout the election period, and in a way, he was the best positioned from the very beginning to benefit from the extended period of political vacuum that had occurred as a result of the impeachment of the previous president and really the loss of any sense of legitimacy from the conservative side of the political spectrum as a result of that scandal.
And how did Moon campaign? What did he campaign on leading up to this election?
Well, he really campaigned in many respects as the inheritor of the mantle of the progressive or liberal forces in South Korea. He wants to expand public sector jobs for South Koreans in order to meet especially a youth employment crisis. He has a more moderate policy toward North Korea. And he has taken a position of wanting to have a little bit more autonomy within the context of the alliance with the United States. Responsibility, I think, is the way he describes it.
Use the word moderation, a more moderate attitude toward North Korea. What does that mean?
Well, it really means that for the progressive side in South Korea, they feel that the missing ingredient in dealing with North Korea in the last 7 or 8 years of conservative rule has been the absence of serious and sincere attempts to engage North Korea through dialogue. They are very concerned about the idea that the inter-Korean relationship and U.S.-North Korea relations are too militarized. And so they want to restore some kind of mechanism for achieving diplomatic balance or at least engagement with North Korea. The big question is whether North Korea really wants to be engaged in that way.
And we know that Moon has been interested in opening economic exchanges between the two countries. Do we know what that might look like?
Well, there is a project that was shut down last year involving basically a special economic zone where South Korean factories were operating in North Korea with North Korean labor. He has pledged to reopen that, but I think that it will be difficult to move forward on that because of UN Security Council resolutions that have been passed sanctioning North Korea for nuclear tests that occurred last year. So we'll have to see. I think that may end up being more of a longer-term aspiration than a near-term reality.
You mentioned just a bit ago that a lingering question is whether North Korea wants to be engaged in any kind of renewed dialogue. Has North Korea responded?
So far, we really haven't heard too much from North Korea other than an expression of distaste for conservatives generally in South Korea, but there has not been a direct response yet to the Moon election that I've seen.
Now, South Korea's former president was impeached under accusations of bribery and corruption. So could you tell us a bit about what kind of political atmosphere that Moon is inheriting in South Korea?
Well, I think the main expectation clearly is that South Korean people want clean politics. They want an environment that provides a level playing field and a sense that decisions are based on merit rather than some kind of fix or interpersonal relationships as a way of gaining some kind of advantage. You know, this kind of issue permeates South Korean society in one way or another because it's a very relationship-centered culture. But increasingly, it appears that if you have privilege begets privilege is the perception that exists. And so I think that the people who voted for Moon would like to see other opportunities opened up for advancement across a wider segment of South Korean society.
We're talking right now with Scott Snyder, Senior Fellow for Korea Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of the book South Korea at the Crossroads. And Scott, you said that Moon is interested in pursuing more moderate relations with North Korea. And at the same time, we have President Trump and his administration taking a hardline approach to North Korea. So how do you see this election changing relationships between the United States and South Korea?
Well, I think that there may be more tensions in the relationship that could arise in the context of a policy by a South Korean leader that really wants to focus on peaceful solutions to the Korean problem. Basically, the main issues of contention revolve around whether or not to put security instruments first as a matter, as a way of problem solving. And that also spills over to the president's attitudes toward a missile defense system that has been put in place in South Korea by the United States that is still politically contested within South Korea, although it does enjoy support from a majority of the broader public.
We have a little bit of President Trump on North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. This is a clip from CBS News.
People are saying, is he sane? I have no idea. I can tell you this, and a lot of people don't like when I say it, but he was a young man of 26 or 27 when he took over from his father, when his father died. He's dealing with obviously very tough people, in particular the generals and others. And at a very young age, he was able to assume power. A lot of people, I'm sure, tried to take that power away, whether it was his uncle or anybody else. And he was able to do it. So obviously, he's a pretty smart cookie.
Some respectful words there from President Trump about North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Do we know whether those words are representative of U.S. policy at this point or whether there looks to be a point of escalation going forward?
Well, we've seen signals like the one that you just played from President Trump, and we've also seen military posturing in the region in recent weeks. And so I think that if it's hard for Americans to figure out which one is in the lead and what the emphasis of the Trump administration is, you can imagine how difficult it is to sort out those signals if you're sitting in Seoul or maybe even more importantly in Pyongyang.
Now, Moon, the new president of South Korea, has been less, I guess, aligned in what he's said so far with U.S. policy toward North Korea. The previous administration, the previous president of South Korea, had been more in lockstep with the vision the United States had. Have we seen any sort of conflict between, at least in words and things the presidents have said so far, Moon and Trump, or are we seeing that we're approaching this new change with caution and maybe optimistic caution, I guess?
Well, I think that in South Korea, from the new president, we have heard the words that Americans would want to hear, an emphasis on denuclearization, expressions of the importance of the alliance. But the methods that the new president wants to pursue are, I guess the way to describe it is that he really wants to make sure that he exhausts all peaceful means. And even then, I'm not sure that the new South Korean leader really wants to see conflict at all, especially conflict driven by the U.S. And so, you know, that's really, I think, both the area of potential convergence in terms of an approach between the U.S. and South Korea. Nobody wants to see a conflict, but it's also a potential divergence. For instance, in the event that the North Koreans can strike the United States directly with a nuclear-capable device, that is going to generate greater calls for finding military solutions if nothing else works.
How central is South Korea to the success of United States policy toward North Korea? If South Korea, with Moon in charge, decides to take a left turn, is that a big hit to U.S. policy?
Well, the alliance has been the structure that has enabled both countries to manage political shifts from left to right. Or right to left over time. It has endured. And I think that the reason is that it embodies a deep strategic logic that the U.S. and South Korea have a shared interest in the preservation of peace and security in the region. The dangers come really with the possibility that unilateral actions might actually endanger peace and security, either from an aggressive South Korea under conservative rule, or potentially, as has existed in recent years, or from precipitous actions unilaterally taken by a U.S. president that would come at very high cost to life and limb in the region, and I would argue to U.S. long-term interests in the region.
Scott, thanks a lot for talking today.
Sure, thank you.
That was Scott Snyder, Senior Fellow for Korea Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of South Korea at the Crossroads. He joined us to talk about the presidential election results in South Korea and what they could mean for the relationship with the U.S. going forward.
We can think about our money in a couple different ways. First, there are the numbers, the dollars and cents, the bank balances, the debt, the interest, the percentages.
But our next guest says it's about more than the numbers, that we all have emotions, feelings, and attitudes about money. And she says many of us at all income levels feel a lot of stress and anxiety about our financial situations. But the good news is there is a lot we can do to deal with all that stress.
Emily Guy Birkin is with us now. She's a finance writer, now based in Milwaukee. Her newest book is End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. She joins us from our Milwaukee studio. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how common, Emily, is money-related stress?
Incredibly common. It is one of the top sources of stress for most people. It causes marital problems. It causes stress in families. It even causes, when there are families that experience money stress, it causes their kids to be more likely to take on credit card debt when they grow up.
And this is all income levels, you write. No matter how much money we have, we might still be prone to being stressed about our money.
Absolutely. Yeah. Money stress knows no specific income level. You can be stressed if you have very little income, and that makes sense. You can be stressed if you have a lot of income, and that's is something that people don't necessarily recognize.
And in your book, you write that not solving these money stress problems can actually make it harder for us to solve our money problems. The emotion can get in the way of dealing with our money.
Absolutely, yeah. Because we can't separate the way we feel about money from how we deal with money, what happens is if you don't have that separation between your emotions and your money decisions, you end up making counterproductive money decisions that can just further entrench the stress that you feel.
And in your book, you're not trying to solve all of our money problems. You're not helping us become financially secure, but you're helping us resolve some of the emotions and stress with our money. How important is it for us to do that?
I would say that it's probably the most important thing you can do with your money, because there are always going to be money problems. And there is, sad to say, no such thing as financial security. I like to say even Warren Buffett would be wiped out by the zombie apocalypse. but there is always something that could wipe out any fortune, no matter how big. So the idea of financial security is kind of an illusion. What you can do is reduce your stress and find a way to think more rationally about your money and make the best decisions with the money you have. And that is the most important thing to do with your money, because that will allow you to always roll with whatever punches are coming, because there will always be money problems no matter where you end up.
And one of the first steps you talk about is figuring out our attitudes, our relationship with money. What kind of things should we start thinking about?
Well, people tend to think of money as being real simple dollars and cents. You know, if you can add and subtract, you understand money. That's the viewpoint that we have. But there's a lot of underlying psychological and emotional meanings we put to money, and even moral meanings we put to money. So people might think that money is a source of shame. And you very often will see that people will assign kind of moral judgments to people having great wealth or people living in poverty. People will think that money is freedom or money is love. And there is some truth to some of these. However, they are not the full truth, and without actually examining and digging into that psychological meaning and moral meaning and emotional meaning you put to money, you're not going to make the best decisions for yourself and your money, because you'll be letting those underlying meanings drive the ship rather than actually making the choices that are the most rational, most intelligent choices for you.
We're talking to Emily Guy Birkin. Her new book is End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. Emily, one of the big issues you talk about is the feeling that our finances are out of our control in one way or another. And that can be somebody at the lowest end of the economic spectrum. It could be somebody in the middle class who's wondering, why can't I figure out how to pay for, say, college for kids? It can even go up higher than that. Why do we feel out of control?
Well, one of the big reasons for it is something that psychologists have identified as the locus of control. You can either have an internal locus of control or an external locus of control. So people with an internal locus of control feel like they have control over what's happening in their lives. So just for example, someone with an internal locus of control who fails a test in college will recognize, hey, I didn't study hard enough. I should have done more. The external locus of control makes it feel like things happen to you, life happens to you. So someone who fails a test with an external locus of control will think, the questions were too hard, the teacher was out to get me, I just can't get a break. So when you have an internal locus of control, you're much more likely to be able to feel like, hey, this money is a puzzle I can solve. It's something I can figure out. Whereas if you have an external locus of control, you're much more likely to think, this is what happens to me, the man is keeping me down. Or there's no way to get ahead, so I might as well not try.
But it sounds like there's a risk that maybe we could go too far and turn that into self-blame as opposed to just self-control when it comes to money.
Absolutely. There's always kind of a balance you need to strike. You know, the internal locus of control, the other problem with that is if you have, you know, too high self-esteem about that sort of thing, you might jump into risky investments because you think, oh, I can't control it, I can handle it, and that sort of thing. And so that could also lead you astray. So those are the sorts of things they're in everything. You need to have a balance and try to figure out what is going to make the most sense rationally, which we all think we're rational, but no one really is. Everyone is irrational about money. And so recognizing when you're being irrational and recognizing when you could make a better decision is really important.
And Emily, suppose somebody listening is thinking, yeah, I do feel like my finances are out of my control. I want to establish that locus of control. What are some good first steps, some practical things we can actually do? You know, it's not going to solve our entire money issue, but to at least feel like, hey, I've got a handle on it. I can take some steps beyond this.
So there's a couple of things you can do. One of the ones that I really like the best is from a motivational writer named James Clear, who he talks about when you want to make a change in your life, the traditional advice is to set a big goal, like, hey, I'm going to lose 25 pounds, or hey, I'm going to pay off all of my debt. Well, there's a problem with that goal-setting advice in that the first time you stumble, you feel like, oh, there's no way I'm going to do this. I'm just going to quit. So instead of making a big goal like that, he says, try to figure out what kind of person you want to be. So you might say, I want to be the type of person who sends money every week to my debt. So you could decide to do that. And so every week, no matter how small the amount is, if it's only $10, if it's only $5, but if every week you send money to pay down your debt above and beyond, you know, the minimums that you have to do, then you, with every week, you are making it clear to yourself, like, hey, I keep promises to myself, I am taking care of my debts, and it kind of snowballs into this feeling like I am a person in control.
And you also talk in the book about budgeting, which often people point to as a first step, but I think a lot of people, I've heard from them on the show in the past, don't really know how to get started. In your book, you talk about a lot of resources out there. What are, for somebody trying to make that first step toward budgeting and maybe finding that level of control, what's a good place to start?
Well, the thing with budgeting is you need to make sure that you budget with your own psychology in mind. A lot of these very detailed budgets, you know, the spreadsheets and all of that, that is not going to work for the vast majority of people. And it's really important that you find a way that works with what you're going to do. Because making the budget's not the hard part, actually. It's adhering to the budget that's the hard part. So there are lots of different things that you can use. There are websites that you can go to that will, like mint.com, for instance, that will aggregate all of your financial choices. And so that will help you just know what's going on. And if you, once someone's tracked the money for you, you can make good decisions. That's a great resource. There's also apps out there that will actually keep track of your money for you and let you know how much you can still spend and still be able to pay all of your bills. So if you're someone who just does not want to pay attention to your money at all, that is a productive way to ignore it. So there's a lot of technology out there right now that makes it a lot easier to find a way to budget without triggering the alarm bells in your head that says, no, I don't want to do this. This is boring.
I want to turn to another source of money and money-related anxiety you talk about in the book. And that's, you know, when we're making a purchase of some sort, medium price, big ticket item, whatever, and the idea that, oh, we've got to research this and we don't want to spend all this money and not make the right decision, even though there might be multiple perfectly adequate decisions. How do we get over that sort of obsession over making sure we don't make that wrong investment decision?
Yes, that's actually Barry Schwartz, who wrote the book, The Paradox of Choice. He has dubbed the people who very much agonize over spending decisions like that as maximizers, whereas the people who say, okay, these are my three bare minimums that I need, as long as it clears those three, it's good enough, those are called satisficers. I'm a satisficer and I'm married to a maximizer. and that's actually a very common pairing. And so what you need to do is set artificial limits for yourself as a maximizer, because the problem with maximizing, you know, you think that trying to get the best option is going to be good. The issue is, even if you spend a great deal of time researching, you still second guess yourself after you've made the purchase, and you can make yourself crazy with the research. So set a time limit to the amount of research you can do. I generally say an hour. You're not looking to become the world's foremost authority on, you know, shingles or whatever it is you're researching. You just need to know enough to make a good decision. And then if at the end of the hour you still don't feel comfortable making a good decision, give yourself another hour, but no more. And that allows you to limit the amount of time that you spend obsessing over it. The other rule that I like to give people is the three then five rule. If you're comparing items, start by comparing three items, figure out which is the best of those three, and then compare another five. And if one of the five is better than the best of three, go with that. If the best of three is still best, go with that. Mm-hmm. You've done your due diligence and you're not going to be making yourself crazy.
We're talking to Emily Guy Birkin, finance writer and author of End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. She has advice on dealing with the stress and emotions surrounding our money so we can do a better job taking care of our finances.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you feel your blood pressure go up just thinking about money? Have you taken steps to deal with your finances? Call in and share your experiences and your questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Emily Guy Birkin is with us to help take some of the stress out of our finances. Her new book is called End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Does it stress you out to talk about money or even think about it? Have you taken some steps to get a handle on your financial situation? What helped? Did it make you feel better, less stressed once you started tackling it? Do you have questions for our guests on how to get started? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Emily, another big emotional issue you write about dealing with money. Resentment, whether of other people, of the system. You say a lot of negative emotion can come out of that, and it doesn't do us much good.
Yes, there's an old saying that resentment is like swallowing poison and expecting the other person to die. And that is very true with money resentment. And while resentment is a pernicious and insidious emotion, no matter why you're feeling it, financial resentment has some more negative aspects to it, including the fact that people will end up trying to spend money because of their financial resentment. And that just kind of entrenches the money stress and the problems. And so it's very important to let go of financial resentment and recognize that there are some things that simply need to be let go, and that that's a gift to you. You are giving yourself a gift by letting go of your resentment rather than feeling like you're condoning whatever it is that you resent.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Jason on the line in Oak Creek. Jason, hi.
Hi. What
do you want to bring up, Jason?
Yeah, my grandfather always... and I was wondering if there was an amount or a percentage that you would give yourself before going on to your bills and whatnot.
Jason, thanks.
Give yourself confidence before...
Your line is fading in and out, but the gist there was his grandfather, he says, told him to pay himself first, Emily. So he's saying, how much, if that's a good philosophy, how much should we set aside before we start allocating that money to other stuff?
That's a great question, and that's unfortunately I'm going to give the you know expert answer of it depends. But yes, you should pay yourself first. And my rule of thumb is try for 20%. If you can't do 20%, do what you can. If you can do more than 20%, do more than 20%. 20% is a good place to just start. It's a baseline. It's an anchor for you to think of, like, that's how much money that I can set aside, pay myself first, as in, you know, put into emergency fund, put into retirement funds, you know, whatever you need to do, you know, put into a down payment for a house that you're saving up for. So if you are able to set aside 20%, and that includes, you know, whatever you're putting aside for your 401k, if you're already putting, let's say, 10% aside for your 401k, that is part of paying yourself first. And so another 10% would get to your 20%. But don't rest on your laurels if you can get to 20% easily. What else can you do? The more that you're able to pay yourself first, the better off you'll be, the more likely you'll be able to reach a financially independent situation where you feel like you don't necessarily need to work, which would be a great place to be.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Back to our callers. Stephanie is with us in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hello. I really love the way in which you're explaining these techniques, because they're probably techniques that you hear over and over again, but until you can relate to it, how it's said, you don't really start doing them. But my question or comment is that when I was younger and single and paying my own bills. I wasn't very good at it. But then I got into a serious relationship, and I was always wanting to combine the accounts, because even though the bills were the same each month, because, you know, we weren't combining our bills yet, we were able to pay more or pay the bills in a more timely fashion and be more comfortable and on top of it. And so I was just wondering what your thought about combining two incomes, whether it be just serious living together relationships versus marriage.
Stephanie, thanks for the call, and talk about a chance for emotion to get wrapped up in our money, Emily. That relationship issue of how fast and how far to combine assets, accounts, bill paying, you name it. What do you think?
The thing that you need to be really careful of is I really advocate everyone always maintaining at least a little bit of financial independence in marriage, in any long-term relationship. And the reason for that is because financial abuse can be a serious problem. And it can go in either direction. You know, a man can financially abuse a woman can financially abuse a man, you know, parents and children. So maintaining some sort of financial independence is always a good idea. So deciding when to combine finances, I think that should be a step that's on par with, you know, even more than moving in together, like signing a lease together, because that step needs to be taken very, very carefully to make sure that you really know who it is that you're combining your finances with, so you know what it is you're getting into and how you'll be able to take care of yourself in case things don't work out.
Thanks, Stephanie, for the call. Good luck. Emily Guy Birkin is with us, author of End Financial Stress Now, trying to take some of the psychological anxiety out of our dealings with money. Here's one you get into, Emily. Temptation. And this is an issue for people, you know, trying to improve their diets, cut down on bad habits, whatever. And, you know, people who have things well under control, but they have that impulsive spending. How do we structure our lives to avoid that kind of temptation that can throw our budget out of whack?
Well, the thing to remember about temptation is that the best way to avoid temptation is to avoid it. They found that the people who are most likely to stick to their goals are the ones who just structure their lives to avoid temptation. So, you know, think of the dieter who has no cookies or ice cream in the house. What I say, you need to find a way to do that within finance. So one suggestion I make is take all of your credit card information off of your favorite retail sites so that you actually have to get up and go get your wallet when you have to pay for something, because that gives you enough of a kind of emotional and mental distance between wanting something and paying for it to decide, do I actually want this? Will this actually help me in any way? Creating a little bit of distance between the time that you are looking at something and the time you decide to buy it is very, very important. The other thing to do with temptation is try to remember your motivation. So remembering your motivation can really help you overcome temptations. So there are several ways to do this. Again, you know, the retail sites, if you choose a password that represents your motivation. So for instance, if you have a child who is going to be going to college in the year 2021, you might make your retail site password 2021 OSU, because that's their preferred school. And that will help you remember, do I really have the money to be spending on Amazon right now when I sign in? So trying to keep those things front and center can really help you have that distance you need to decide if the momentary temptation is worth the long-term goal.
Very briefly, as we wrap up, Emily, do people take the emotional side of money seriously enough?
No, I don't think they do. We tend to think that money is simple dollars and cents. Everyone should be able to handle it because everyone can add and subtract. And so people don't realize how emotional money is for them.
We'll leave it there for now. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Emily Guy Birkin, finance writer and author of the book End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. You can share your thoughts. Maybe you've got some advice that you can add to what Emily has been talking about. Have you succeeded, whatever your income and wealth level, have you succeeded in overcoming economic anxiety? Let us know how you did it. Share a tip, share some advice with the other listeners out there. You can do that on the Central Time Facebook page, or of course, as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Again, share your financial stress beating advice on the Central Time Facebook page. Big celebrity news in Wisconsin that turned out to be non-news. I saw this on Twitter today, quoting from a post from Slate magazine, quote, Kanye West has reportedly retired to a Wisconsin mountaintop to make his new album.
And yeah, obviously, there's a loaded sentence there. It raises some big questions. One, why is one of the most famous celebrities in the world picking Wisconsin for his retreat? Two, where is this so-called mountaintop? Because I am pretty sure Wisconsin, well, is not generally known for its rarefied songwriting retreat-like lofty mountaintops.
On further review and actually clicking on the link, it turns out he's actually going to another W state, Wyoming, not Wisconsin.
Yeah, suddenly it makes sense.
Yeah, I did tweet back a picture of Tim's Hill, the highest point in Wisconsin, which I could see. You know, there's room for the paparazzi to surround it. There's that big structure there he could record on, maybe not.
Yeah, it's not the same. I mean, we do have the Bon Iver mystique here.
Right. And
where one might, you can see when I retire to a cabin in, I don't know, western Wisconsin.
Right.
That makes
Driftless
sense.
Driftless area or something.
Driftless
yeah.
area makes sense. But yeah, a mountaintop in Wisconsin does not quite compute.
I did just some research. Tim's Hill in Wisconsin, 1,951 feet. Highest point in Wyoming, Gannett Peak, 13,804 feet. We do get beaten in the mountain category.
Slight difference.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. So lonely.